Elliot, we haven't even hit double digits on the podcast yet, but already we're talking about Tom Dundon twice. News breaking last night. We're recording this podcast at 1:50 Eastern on Thursday. News breaking last night that Ron Francis has been demoted upwards, I think might be the most appropriate way to put it. No longer general manager of the Carolina Hurricanes, now president of hockey operations for said franchise. The GM position is vacant for now, but the power structure in this and the reporting structure is an interesting one, and one that we don't necessarily see in hockey. Describe it for us.
Well, I think a better way, you call it demoted upwards.
Demoted upwards.
Demoted sideways. You know, I think that Ron Francis, he's obviously still a part of the organization. And when I spoke to Tom Dundon on Thursday morning, he bent over backwards to say that to good things about Francis and say that his opinion will still be valued as part of the new group. But they are going to hire a general manager, and that general manager is going to report directly to the owner. And that's the way it's going to work. So Ron Francis is still going to be part of the organization, but he's not going to be a key decision maker anymore.
So Dundon himself will have more influence on the day-to-day operations
of
the team?
Well, that's what we've all been kind of wondering.
Like, that's what I'm nudging towards here in this conversation.
So I spoke to him Thursday, and I wrote 31 Thoughts, and it's now out, and he kind of explains it. And the way he explains it, it makes sense, I understand, to him. But to a lot of us, it's very different. And basically, he said, look, I don't want to make the decisions. And I said to him, you know, that's not the impression a lot of people have. The impression is that you do want to make the decisions. He says, this is how I want it. And he suggested I go find an article about the Philadelphia Eagles, who won the Super Bowl this year, and about the way they approach fourth down conversions. And I'm not going to tell the story in the way that he said it to me. I'm going to do it this way because it's easier. So after the interview, I went and I found this article. And basically, it's by a guy named Tim McManus, and it's written on the ESPN website. And when the Eagles were about to play the Vikings in the NFC Conference Final, the NFC Championship game, the Vikings coach, Mike Zimmer, talked about how the Eagles went for it a lot on fourth down, and they were successful. So this guy, Tim McManus, this reporter, he spoke to Frank Reich, who was their offensive coordinator, and he said that we sit down before the season and we go over all the situations where you would go for on fourth down. What's the down and distance? What's the situation? Stuff like that. And he said, well, we have a green zone that says if it's set up like this, you always go for it. We have a red zone, and it says if it's set up like this, you never go for it. And we have a yellow zone where you kind of have to make a choice. And that's how we do it. And the Eagles were very good at it, very good at challenging on fourth down. And so whenever they got close, they reviewed those situations. So getting back to Dundon, what he said to me was, that's what I want. He says, I don't care for yellow. I'm not interested in, you know, where you don't have the answer. I care about green, where you know to do something, or red, where you know not to do something. And he said, I want to create a situation where somebody can put that model together so that I don't need to approve all the decisions because I know from our model this is what we're going to be doing. And that's what he wants. And, you know, it's different. You know, somebody sent me a note this morning saying, after I wrote that, he said, I don't know if there's a general manager in the NHL who's really built for that. It's a new skill set than what we've heard. So I don't know if he goes totally off the board with his next hire or what, but this is going to be very different.
It's different, although the art of the general manager in a lot of ways, when the new CBA came in 2005, many maintained, and I was one of them, the art of the general manager has been not completely revolutionized, but it's been diminished in a lot of ways. There became a team salary cap. There became an individual salary cap. There became a rookie salary cap. And in a lot of ways, you know, you talk about, you know, the green zone and the red zone. A lot of those decisions were already made for those general managers.
Yes.
So it was just plugging in. And so that art of making those deals was gone. Is this any different? Or is this just the next step in diminishing what the general manager's duties are day to day with his team?
I think that's a great question. I think if this goes the way that Dundon wants it to go, and other teams do copy this if it works, then I don't see it as eliminating the job or decreasing the job. I see it more as evolving the job, because then what you're doing is you're setting the process for your organization. And to me, that's a pretty big job. Now, I've got a lot of people writing to me today saying this will never work, and it's like what Florida did last year, and they had to go back to the old way because it didn't work. I mean, time will tell. We'll see if this is different. But if it does work, Jeff, then it's going to come down to this is the way – this is going to be the general manager's new responsibility. Like, one thing that stood out to me this year was I asked Jim Nill what's the biggest thing he learned about being a GM, and he said it's not making the hockey decisions – it's managing people. Mm-hmm. It's managing up. It's putting people in the right places to succeed. And I think this would become an even bigger offshoot of that.
See, I've read a lot of the Florida Panthers comparisons. And, oh, they tried this with analytics before, and it didn't work, so let's just stop talking about it altogether. This was my great fear with the Florida Panthers. Because I've waited for some teams to go all in on it and really stick with it. I thought Colorado at one point would have been the best team to try it with initially. Mm-hmm. But Florida became the lab rat for it. And did it work out? I don't think we can really say, to be honest with you, because it wasn't given a long enough time before the knee-jerk reactions happened and people got fired and they quickly regrouped and went to a more traditional model. But my fear out of all of that was one team was going to try it, and it would become an audit on an analytics-based management style for everybody else. Look, it didn't work. The analogy that I've been raising to counter that is Cy Denneny. Now, Cy Denneny played hockey 70 years ago.
Is going to be something.
You'll like this. And he was the
this
first.
This is going to be a comparison.
He was the first player to do what in the NHL, with all apologies to Bobby Hull? He was the first player to curve a stick.
Okay.
He was the first player to use a curve stick. Now, if Cy Denneny, first player to use a curve stick, went out there on the ice, took a shot with the curve stick, and it missed the net, should he have gone back to a flat blade? Well, you know what? He had a curved stick, shot the puck, it missed. Let's not try that anymore. Obviously, these curved sticks don't work because you can't hit the net with it. That was my fear for the Florida situation. One team was going to try it, and if it didn't work, it would give everybody who has an anti-analytics-based slant enough fuel and ammunition to say, look, that doesn't work. Let's just stop with all this now and go back to a more eyeball approach in the NHL.
I don't think you're wrong. Personally, I think the whole analytics versus eye test debate is stupid. Like, if you're not using both, you're not going to win. There's a certain element of we should look at data and see what it tells us. And there's a certain element of I like and I trust what I see. And you have to find a way to make them work together. I think anybody who argues against either is not somebody I want around on my team.
One little injection there. Everybody uses analytics. They just don't call it that.
Right.
They just call it information. Like, the original analytic, okay, in the NHL was assists. If you go back to the original game sheets in the NHL, on the game sheets themselves, the NHL encourages the official scorer to include assists. And at the time, the thought was, well, hang on, how come that's worth as much as the guy that scored the goal? How come an assist is 1 point and so is a goal? That makes no sense. That guy didn't score the goal. It was greeted the same way that Corsi and Fenrick. How does that relate to the success of a team or not? So in a lot of ways, assists were the very first analytic and were probably greeted the same way that even plus minus was greeted in 1968 when it first started. So everybody uses, I just call it information.
Yes.
I hate the term analytics because it gets people's backs up and it polarizes people and it creates a divide. If we just called it all information-based governing.
I like that.
Team,
I'm good with
I
that.
I think we're all being a much happier place.
Everybody uses information, and I agree with you. That's what you do. You know, I think the problem in Florida was they tried to do too much too quick. They changed too much of a team that was going in the right direction. And, you know, I think off the ice, too, they made a lot of changes that rubbed people the wrong way. And, you know, if you're going to do something like that, you have to have the conviction to stay with it for a long time, and the organization didn't.
I want to pick up more of the conversation with Tom Dundon and the future of the Carolina Hurricanes in a couple of moments. In the meantime, we'll start the podcast officially. Welcome to 31 Thoughts, the podcast brought to you by the all-new 2018 GMC Terrain.
Hi, this is Nick Kyprios from Hockey Night in Canada, and you're listening to 31 Kipper Thoughts that Elliot passes on as his own.
That may be the best one yet. Thank you very much, Nick Kyprios of Hockey Night in Canada and Sportsnet. Much appreciated there for that. A couple more thoughts on the Carolina Hurricanes situation. You write about this week at Sportsnet.ca in 31 Thoughts. And a lot of people have mused about this already, and the whispers are already out there. What does this mean for Bill Peters? And we spoke on this podcast a while ago, and you mentioned how Tom Dundon was skeptical about Bill Peters at first and then had a long conversation with him and sort of turned around. Where are you at on the future of Bill Peters with the Carolina Hurricanes organization now that Ron Francis is no longer in his previous capacity?
You know, as we sit here right now, I admit I don't know. I really don't know. He's got one more year on his contract, just like Francis did. People think he's a good coach. Most of the reviews I get on him are positive. It's interesting. Like, we talked about analytics in the last segment. Mm-hmm. I'm curious to see how he is with it because...
Peters?
Yeah.
Really good.
It looks like they're going to be hiring more of it.
Him and Eric Tulsky are, you know, one phone call away from each other and right down the hallway from each other, as I understand.
Yeah. So there you go. So, because I think they're going to be hiring more of them. I can't decide as we sit here today... Is the coach in Carolina going to have more power or less power? Now, some believe it'll be more power because the GM's going to have a different kind of role. But there's others. If you look what's happening in baseball right now, the managers have less power than ever. You look at a lot of the guys who got hired. Ever since Moneyball came out, it's, no, we don't care what you think. You're going to manage it the way we dictate from up top.
And you think hockey's going to be the same way? Like, if we don't dump the puck in, sir, we carry it over.
Well, if Tom Dundon's talking about a model, and one of the things he actually talked about with me, Jeff, that I didn't put in the article because it was just too much extraneous, was pulling the goalie. Like, what does the information say?
Thank you.
About pulling the goalie? Do you do it with 3.5 minutes left?
Yeah.
So
everyone sort of aped Patrick Waugh, which is about three and a half minutes.
But
down
that's
the goal,
but that
down.
Is the way that I think Dundon wants. He wants it to go like he wants to watch a game, understand the models that his team has put together, and say, I know what to expect. Now, there's a big debate about whether or not that would even work in hockey because the game is so random. But in theory, that's what he wants. He wants to sit there. If his team is losing in the third period, he wants to be able to sit there and say, I know we're going to pull the goalie based on our situation at X. So let's say it's 3.5 minutes, 3.5 minutes left, the goalie goes. Now, you tell me, does that make the coach more or less powerful?
Less.
Right. But somebody's got to pick the players. So I don't know how to answer this question. I think we're all going
to
find this out together.
Further to that, I had a long conversation last night after the Calgary-Buffalo game with Dave Randorf, play-by-play voice, last night alongside Kelly Rudy in that game. And we talked about face-offs and the idea of deliberately losing face-offs and the advantage you can gain when you deliberately lose a face-off in the offensive zone. I've told this story a couple different times and share for this audience now. There were two teams in the NHL, this is a few years ago, who did a study just amongst the two of them, two Canadian-based teams, about the effects of losing a face-off versus winning a face-off on the power play, offensive zone draws. Common wisdom is you want the puck. You have to win the face-off. We need possession. We need to dictate and we'll be the ones that decide where the puck is going. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Always want to win the draw. If you look at how scoring chances are created, again, this is only a two-team audit, but what they found over the course of a season on power play, offensive zone face-off, you create more scoring chances by losing a face-off than by winning one. Here's the theory. You win the face-off, the puck goes back to the point, everybody claps it to the net. That puck needs to go through at least four bodies even to get to the goaltender. If you lose the face-off, the puck's going behind the red line. If you have a strong forecheck that can force a turnover there, automatically you turn the puck over and you're in a position for a good chance on goal, for a scoring chance right there. Now, I don't know any coach, Elliot, that would say on the power play to tell their center, although Anaheim does this, to go out there and deliberately lose the face-off, knowing that it will gain you better advantage on the ice. Interesting, though, mm-hmm. I mean, hockey is one of the few sports where you surrender the object of play for advantageous position on the field.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the dump-in. We consider that to be smart strategy. But I don't know many people when I say it's smarter to lose a face-off deliberately to give yourself better positioning. No one says that I've met has said that's a really smart play, but isn't it just the same as a dump-in? Losing a face-off deliberately. Anaheim would do this all the time. When Maroon played on the Anaheim Ducks.
Well, Boudreau was a big believer in that because he felt their guys couldn't win enough draws. So he said we better develop some plays for that.
Well, you know what? It's funny because and whenever Getzlaff would be out there, his line would be out there.
Lanvino in New York, too, went through a stretch where he was very big on that.
Deliberately losing draws?
Well, because he felt we couldn't win one, so we better start to figure out a way.
I mean, Getzlaff wouldn't even wave at the puck, though. The visual to me, I've always dreamed about this. If you have a coach who's really willing to go for this, and deliberately lose face-offs, strong forecheck, force a turnover. I would love to see someone approach the face-off with his stick on his shoulder and just say, drop it. Now you got to have his stick down. I get all that. But to approach it just with the idea that I'm not going to go anywhere near this puck. Because Getzlaff would just leave his stick out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, remember when Ryan Nugent-Hopkins was a rookie, he would dine out on Nugent-Hopkins this way, and Perry and Maroon would forecheck Petrie or Davidson or whomever. Puck would turn over, and they would have a scoring opportunity. But to your point about, you know, the percentages and where do you pull a goaltender, I wonder if anyone's going to get to that level. We're losing faceoffs on purpose.
Oh, I think
it's smarter for us.
I think Anaheim did.
Anaheim totally did. But at what point do other coaches go along with that?
I think it happens more often than we realize or even really look to. I bet you if people listening to this really started looking to it, you could find tons of examples in a game where that happens.
Yeah.
Sometimes I wonder if coaches bring up face-off percentages of certain guys to throw us off the scent of that, too.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I do.
Face-offs are essentially the beginning of a chain of possession, right? It goes, that's the face-off. That puck goes back to the defenseman. That defenseman sends it to another defenseman, sends it to a winger. But that's just a chain.
Yep.
And we somehow give primacy to that first point in the chain. No primacy to the second pass, the third pass, the fourth pass. But it's all a chain, right? That's all it is. We give no primacy to it, no stat for it at all. Anyway, I'm getting diverted here, but
I understand. Like, there's a lot of things about hockey we're rethinking. Right, we're going into a different era, and sports science is a big one. I mean, we're constantly changing the amount of time that we're practicing or not practicing.
Mm-hmm.
The morning skates are starting to go away, and you know the other thing too is, and this is also what Dundon is a part of. It's a lot more money now to own a team, right? The owners are a lot more involved than ever. They're really involved. And in a lot of their businesses, they made money by doing that extra 1%, right? So if you can convince them of something in hockey that might give you a 1% chance more better of winning,
mm-hmm.
that is the language they speak of. I think Tampa's – like if you work in Tampa, it's really lucky because you've got Jeff Vinnick there and he just backs off. But I don't think there's going to be a lot of guys like that anymore.
I was going to say, do you think this is the new model of ownership? I mean, to your point, they spend a lot of money on these teams. And
yeah.
I can only imagine spending, you know, the hundreds of millions of dollars to buy an NHL team and then just back up and say, okay, I've bought this now. You run it. I'll see you at Christmas time, and I'll see you at the end of the season.
Yeah, you know, I really think, Jeff, if you ask GMs or executives who have been around a long time, you manage up a lot more than you ever had to.
Yeah. Now you've made that point before,
too. Yeah, managing up is your most important skill.
Carolina Hurricanes, last one on this one. Do you see them more – get back to Bill Peters here. And I see the issue more of composition than coaching. Do you think this is a coaching or composition issue right now with the Carolina Hurricanes? This team has been false started that more than any other team, I think, in the NHL in the last 4 years. Since they started to begin to have that
Everybody's trendy pick every year, right?
I've stopped with the hipster pick of Carolina. I'm done with it, right? It's the first year that I finally stopped saying Carolina because I've been burned so many times. Win 5, lose 3.
Well, you know,
win 6, lose 7.
I think, Jeff, it's really hard to win when you are that low a payroll team. You know, every GM makes mistakes. Like one of the things that Ron Francis is getting hammered for today is that
Scott Darling?
Is Scott Darling.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, every GM is going to make a mistake. But when you are on a team where your budget is lower or your cap hit is so low consistently, your mistakes are more pronounced. You know, Toronto acquired Colin Greening, and they said, you know what, Colin, it may not work out for you here, but you're going to go down to our American Hockey League team. You're going to be the captain. You're going to make your $2.5 million.
Not going to pay escrow.
You're not going to pay escrow, and you're going to teach our young players about what it's like, and you're going to be a good example. Now, Carolina, for the first time, really did that this year.
Saw that.
They did it with Marcus Kruger. But I think that when you're wealthy, you can eat a mistake or two. Carolina can't. And, again, people are ripping Francis for that. I just think that one of the reasons that it's harder to win there is because your mistakes are magnified. They can't be erased as easy. And you're going to make a mistake. It's life. And I think that's why teams like Carolina, it's harder to win.
Maybe I just oversimplify things in my life, but I look at Carolina and I say the issue there has been goaltending. And it still is. You mentioned Scott Darling. And previous to that, you know, Cam Ward, love him in 2006, was fantastic, was all world. At times in stretches, he's looked really good. But overall, I don't think Cam Ward's given them the goaltending they need to be competitive in the NHL. Lack of a legit first-line center is a struggle, too, for Carolina right now. But what's the old saying? If you have a goalie, it's 70% of your team. If you don't, it's 100%. Right? I mean, who knows that better than Carolina?
We're talking about New York, like Alain Vigneault's line, if my goalie's better than your goalie, I win. If yeah. your goalie's better than my goalie, you win. You know what the other thing, too, is? It's funny you brought up Cam Ward today because I got a text from someone today. And they said to me that this could open up a whole can of worms. I can see where this is going to go. That Carolina's shot people are notoriously stingier than other teams.
Carolina's?
Like the people who count shots.
Who count shots? Crew. They're stingier?
That's the word.
It's funny because Carolina's kind of that team that warms up its Corsi every first period, right? They warm up the Corsi, tons of shots, flood the net.
Well, that's the thing. Like,
remember, I talked to one guy from the Carolina Hurricanes, and he used that phrase specifically.
Well,
first period,
we warm up
our Corsi.
I was told that if Cam Ward played in, say, Philly, his save percentage would be better because they're more liberal at counting shots than Carolina is.
Really?
Yes. And I was told that today. And this is a critical broadcaster mistake to go with it before checking it. But what the hell? It's one of those things that people aren't going to really confirm or deny to you. But, like, for example, one of the stories I was told was that if there's a shot in from center and it could go in, Philly would count that as a shot. And there were times that Carolina wouldn't because they weren't trying to score. It was like a flip away or shot away.
Yeah.
And we do know that around
the
league,
is there enough volume to really affect a goalie
save
percentage?
Somebody's going to do a study on that. I'm just telling you what was raised to me actually this morning.
By the way, Emil Dalich, our producer, presents me 0.909 career save percentage for Cam Ward.
Yes.
And you say that may be artificially low.
Well, I'm just saying that this was raised to me today. That Carolina has a reputation as being really stingy with counting some shots, and that there were people who felt, and this is not somebody who works in Carolina, but he did say that the talk around goalie circles is that the Carolina numbers, and it's good for the team because it makes their Corsi percentage better.
Yeah.
But it's bad for the goalies because it makes their save percentage worse.
Fascinating. You know what?
I have no idea if this is true, but I'm here to throw it out in the open.
You know what Doug McLean always says? I'm not telling you it's true. I'm just telling you what I heard.
Yeah, that's right. That's what I'm doing right now.
Well, listen, for the longest time, we've always had to raise a Spockian eyebrow, so to speak, about the hit counts with the Islanders, specifically that fourth line.
Yes, the Islanders always get ripped for that.
Now,
that's true.
There's a great story that someone told me years ago who was on this Oilers team. You know the Dan McGillis story?
Maybe not. Not off the top of my head.
So Edmonton decides they're going to trade Dan McGillis.
Okay.
But they need to pump him. This is the day before. You know, you're watching every single game. This is before, you know, 24-hour hockey coverage. And so what they had is the hit stats for Dan McGillis, all of a sudden, I mean, this is a nice slight by Glenn Sather, all of a sudden the hit stats start to get inflated, and it's turning him into a killer.
I didn't know this, but I'm not surprised.
Look at Dan McGillis. Every game, it's a dozen hits. This guy is a killer. So Philly bites, and they thought they were getting a killer. They wanted to move off from Dan McGillis. Philadelphia thought they were getting the next big bone-crunching body checker in the NHL. Dan McGillis is a really nice player, but because they inflated the hit stats for Dan McGillis, he was presented as someone that he really wasn't. So
that's one where you better look at the eye test. Yeah, that's one where the eye test.
Well, that's
matters.
One where you're not like flipping on your iPad every night and watching hockey games to see exactly what you're getting. So, but
that's interesting. I'm not surprised that happens. Based on that story I just told you, nothing would surprise me.
Elliot, before we get to Oscar Clefbaum, because you stirred it up here a little bit on the weekend, I want to get to our guests. The all-new 2018 GMC Terrain is the compact SUV thoughtfully designed with you in mind. With features like the Traction Select system to revolutionize how you adapt to the road, a fold flat front passenger seat to give you up to 8 feet of cargo space, and an innovative electronic precision shift system to make shifting easier than ever, the 2018 GMC Terrain is truly mighty like a pro. GMC, we are professional grade. Elliot, furthering our discussion of navel gazing on this podcast, we continue to maybe just populate this podcast with our friends and coworkers. In that spirit, Brian Spear has been the producer of Hockey Night in Canada for 12 years. Matt Marstrom has been with Rogers Sportsnet going on 19 years. He produces the Scotiabank Wednesday night program and Rogers Hometown Hockey on Sundays. And true or false, the highlight of your weeks, the highlight of your jobs is working with talent.
Elliot specifically.
Like, who's the worst?
Way to start.
I figured we get the easy questions out of the way.
No one's worse. No one's better.
Everyone's great.
Different.
Everyone. Yeah. Nice.
You know what? And I think that.
A very hockey answer of you, Brian.
I think there is a hockey analogy to it. It's like a dressing room in that every talent is different.
And everybody's got good days and bad days, but on the whole, everybody's great to work with.
Elliot's going to be different than Jeff. Nick's going to be different than Kelly.
Doug's different than Darren.
Yeah.
Yeah, everybody. Just have to deal with.
You just hope they're all not having a bad day on the same day.
And it is herding cats, right?
Okay, so then let me further to that then. Let's say that we'll jump right in. You're both having a bad day, okay? Marcy, the Wednesday night show has gone in the ditch. You know, hockey
night.
Which
never happens.
Which never happened. Not with you there, Elliot. No, sir. Hop on the beat. Brian's Saturday night has gone off the rails, and the show's over, and you're leaving the studio. What's the angriest you've been? Do you ever let it get to that point? Or when you leave the control room, are you done? You just take a deep breath and it's over.
Well, you know, Marcy, you often bike home. So I figure like
that's smart.
Outstanding.
It's huge.
Way.
Yeah, like the director that I work with, Steve Lopez, is we vent on the way home if something bad happened. And by the time I'm home to see my wife before I go to bed, it's gone.
Like even in the dead of winter, you bike, right?
I do.
That's smart.
You're nuts.
For most part. There's a couple of days where you can't do it because it's like you're taking your life in your own hands. But for the most part, it's an easy way to get to work.
So give us an example, guys.
The maddest?
Yeah.
There was a time a wall got a foot put through it. But that would be going back a while.
You break your foot?
No, the wall.
It was,
it was
your
only
foot the wall?
Plaster.
Oh, okay. Nice target.
And I don't even remember what it was over, but it was probably just accumulation of – it was playoffs where you're in there every night.
Was that at the score when we were at the score
together? No, that was at a hockey night.
It was, eh?
Yeah. And but it would have been 8 or 10 years ago. Like it's going back a while.
Yeah.
Now I do find having more experience, able to deal with it more, so feeling mad when you leave. But Elliot will know, like after the shows on Saturday nights, often we sit around and chat for a while, Elliot, Nick, Kelly, David, whoever. And that is actually a very good release of, and it's often, you know, how it went, pat ourselves on the back, but it also does give you that chance to right away, if there's anyone's feeling not good about something, they can immediately talk about it. And that's not the idea of it. It just kind of happened that way, but it has kind of been a good exercise.
I won't say who or when, but a very famous mistake happened on Sportsnet under my watch, and had no idea it was coming, and it was bad. Yeah, it was bad, and it was the angriest I've ever been at work, and if I could have found the person, I probably would have been fired, but I said everything I needed to say over headset and still probably could have got fired for what I said.
How long ago was this?
15 years ago.
So this is the thing, because now – like the rules are changing in terms of what you can say to people now.
Yeah.
Like, and the four of us, we're lucky in the sense that we can speak to each other very honestly. When something goes wrong or these two guys are not happy with me, I know that they will tell me, Elliot, we do not like you right now, and this is why. But in terms of managing people, how much has it changed since you guys started your careers?
Completely. Like, when I first started, like you said, a locker room, it was a locker room, and it was different, you know.
Listen, I've been in control rooms where it's been nasty. In the truck, I've been in there during games, and it's nasty. And there's salt on everyone's tongue.
And I think everybody's not matured, or we just learned as we've gone. Like, I think we all came into the business a whole lot younger, and things were said and things were done, and everything's become more corporate, and you can't be that way. It probably should never have been that way in the first place, but it's just the way it was. Like, you came into the business hearing these stories of producers screaming at people over headsets, and, you know, then you end up meeting some of those guys as you work your way through the business, and you're just like, I don't want to be that guy with a recording going around the internet of what I said.
I think it had the shift had already kind of started before probably Marzi and I got into it. Like, I feel like that's almost going back 20 years ago, that the yelling and the screaming, I think it had certainly lessened by the time we got there. But now you couldn't even come close to doing that, to speaking to someone, because, and rightfully so, you would be, it's abusive in some of the ways that people were talked to back in those days.
It's weird the way that people wear it as a badge, though. Like, yeah. I was in the truck when... And, you know, I was in the control room when I worked under this guy, and it's almost become this proud battle scar that everybody wears. Like, oh, yeah, I survived that.
Right.
It's like going to war. It's like, oh, yeah, it's my NOM story.
No, true. And you wanted to be the guy that was there and wasn't the one getting the brunt of it. Right?
I'm curious. One of the things, and Elliot, you mentioned this to the guys off air. One of the things about this podcast is showing people how things get put together, right?
Yeah.
Taking apart the watch and seeing how it works. We'll start with Hockey Night. I mean, this is such a long-running property, you know, the most important television property probably in the history of Canadian broadcast, and that brings with it a certain weight and a certain gravity. When you start the week, or maybe the question is, when do you start? A, when do you start putting the show together, Brian? And B, what's in the back of your mind, and how much does the weight of 60-plus years sort of carry into each and every week?
First part of the weight of 60 years, I don't think you can ever sit there and think about that. You guys have both been on the show.
Yeah.
You both know what that –
feel that too.
But if I don't think you sit there every week, if you have that burden of that over you all the time, I don't think you can properly do the job.
But isn't part of it there's a certain expectation for Hockey Night, and these are the shoulders that I'm sitting on, and oh, this was Ward Cornell's spot and Dave Hodge and Ron McLean. There are shoulders you sit on all the way up.
Absolutely, and you're – very conscious of that, but I just don't think you can get too caught up in that, because otherwise you're going to be too intimidated by the position. I think that is something when you start in it, it's definitely there more than it would be after 10 or 12 years, right, where now it's worried about week to week. So the second part of how you start, I don't think you ever stop. And it's the same as all of us, I think. You're always thinking about ideas or thinking about the next show or thinking about something that maybe is 3 weeks down the road. This might be a good idea for down the road. Or if it's in the element of feature stories, you're looking weeks, sometimes months ahead at this would make sense to go here. So it's a process that kind of doesn't really stop. So to say, on Tuesday, I'm going to start working on the show. I don't really feel like that. I feel like...
But at a certain point, you put the lineup together.
When
does that happen?
The lineup would start working on it in my head on Tuesday, maybe, but probably wasn't get finalized till Saturday because, you know, people use the comparison often in Monday Night Football and Hockey Night in Canada, but they're not. They're not the same at all, because in football, you have a whole week where there's no games taking place. In hockey, there's games Friday night or there's games on Tuesday night. So you still Saturday afternoon. You still have to be versatile and open enough to be able to make change to that. You need a plan going before that, and you need to kind of think about some of the other big stories you're going to do, but you have to be versatile to change things.
It was like for Wednesday, like I think 3 years ago, Elliot and I had 3 or 4 weeks in a row where we had the show planned out. We're like, okay, this is what we're going to do. And then like half an hour before the show, a trade would happen. Or Elliot broke the Johansson trade on the air.
At 6:30.
Right at 6:30. And I was like, well,
there's a show.
The show. Okay, so the show that you planned for is out the window. It's like, okay, we got to do this, get reaction.
Yeah.
Taping this on Thursday. That happened last night. In the first period, we heard about the Ron Francis news broke.
Yep.
And we didn't break that, but all of a sudden, the rest of the night was dominated by Ron Francis discussion.
It's so funny, because I was doing ringside for that, and in my ear, I could hear you guys in studio as I was doing an interview with Ryan O'Reilly, and as I finished, I had Darren in my ear clearly talking about how Elliot has information about how Ron Francis has, I can't remember the term that he used, but essentially—
reassigned.
That was it. There's been a reassignment in Carolina, and all of a sudden, boom, and I mentioned it to O'Reilly, and he was like, face got long, holy smokes, and mentioned a couple of Calgary Flames players as well. So in a lot of ways, you're, I guess in the back of your mind, you have to prepare for your A plan just to turn into your B plan. Like, you're planning your backup show.
Totally. You plan your best show, and you're ready to adapt. Like, something happens that morning, somebody gets traded, somebody gets hurt in practice. You know, you just you have to be able to adjust. You can't build it like a cement plan. You just, it has to fully be fluid.
And really, the rundown is what people will say, you know, that's your job, is to fill that out. But really, the job is, after that is done, is A, communicating it to everybody else, and B, being able to adjust on the fly. That's a major part of it.
Now, when I mentioned to some people that you were coming on, they were like, ask them what it's like to deal with Ron and Don.
And you talk about the history of the show.
Yeah. Doesn't coaches just kind of run on its own by this point? There's obviously different content every week, but actually, like, the janitorial work of getting it to air, I mean, that's – you've done it for so long.
I mean, you talk about the history of it and the 65 years of it. That's Ron and Don. Like, that's where you have that iconic part of it. That's where you take the real exciting part, is it to do the show with those guys. And as far as it running on its own, yeah, it – I mean, Don's got his own way of doing it, and he's done it his own way for a lot of years. So that's kind of locked in. He has a process, and it's him and Ron talk on Saturday mornings, and they talk to Kathy Broderick, and they go through the list of elements that Don wants, and then Don shows up at 5 o'clock, and we go through all Don's things, and that can take – sometimes that takes a half an hour. Some things it takes longer. And he sees everything and kind of runs through it in his mind again. And then he watches the period, and as the period goes on, he's going to take some things out of the game, but he also might change what he wants to do. So you're right, Jeff, that process is kind of in place, but like everything else, it's still fluid. And it can still be fluid on air. You guys, mm-hmm. Everyone sees how sometimes on air they just decide, let's now do this. It is the most intimate segment in television. And, you know, I've always said radio is like the most intimate, where you actually get to know people. Really, Coach's Corner has that radio-like feel, where people feel like they know Ron and Don, like mm-hmm. they're close to them. It's an unbelievable skill that they've been able to do that for that many years. But it's just like a conversation, and everyone else is just sitting there watching it.
6 minutes once a week, right? But you still have that feeling that you know so much about them.
Right. And as much preparation as I just went through to go into it, I think when you watch, it feels very unrehearsed and very free-flowing.
Marzi, you see Ron on Sunday nights, and I think the most incredible thing Ron does is, and Rogers has murdered him with some killer travel between Saturday in Toronto and Sunday, wherever hometown hockey might be. Like, the weekend of Hockey Day in Canada, he went from Corner Brook, Newfoundland, all the way to British Columbia.
Yeah, to the island.
So sometimes he's tired, but he loves that show. Like, I think you can make an argument that at times he loves hometown hockey more than he likes Hockey Night in Canada. So how do you see him doing that show, sometimes very tired, after doing Hockey Night in Canada the night before?
I don't know how he does it. Like, my friends ask him, what's it like working with him? Like, he's a rock star. He is. It's just the travel, like working Saturday, traveling. He has to know that town inside and out, wherever we are, you know, and he... I just want to sleep on that plane. I wouldn't want to have to think about anything, but he's doing research. He's figuring it out. He's sending me pictures of him on the plane so we can use it for part of the travel. Like, he's got all these ideas going through his head the whole time, and I just can't believe he's able to do what he does. As soon as we say, you know, 3, 2, 1, we're on air, mm-hmm. it's go time, and he always knows what's coming up next. He every once in a while wants to know what we're doing, and he may ask for Brian on Saturday or me to remind him, but it's amazing what he can remember and how he can just come up on the fly with some anecdote to move the story along. It's amazing.
He is, and this is no offense to either of you, the most talented guy that I've ever worked with.
Oh,
there
how
was,
dare you?
There was 1 year during the playoffs.
Emil, shut off their microphone.
Yeah. There was 1 year.
Thank you for joining us, Brian.
There was 1 year during the playoffs. He actually said, this year, let's not do it with any scripts, no rundowns. Just tell me what's next. And we went through the entire playoffs. I never gave him a piece of paper with the rundown on it. Well, we met before and went through it,
yeah.
Talked about it, but it was almost like he was challenging himself to do it.
What, hang on, I want to pause. I want to jump in, and Elliot, you're going to get involved in this conversation here too, because one of my favorite elements of Hockey Night was always Satellite Hot Stove, now Saturday's Headlines, which I always love. But in the world right now of instant information and social media, the idea of embargoing news until the second intermission, at times, can it feel like a dicey proposition? Like, Elliot, you're sitting on something, CJ sitting on something, Nick sitting on something. Are you guys just hoping that nothing comes out before that second intermission headline segment?
That happens. That happens.
How tough is it?
Nick and I have
had, do you embargo news in 2018?
Well, Nick and I have had big philosophical debates about should we hold it or do we send it out and then own it or try to anyway in that segment. I prefer to hold as much as I can, but I have been burned because I've waited. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you guys feel.
Yeah, I think it's we've had that discussion, and it's a per-story basis, right? Like, is it going to hold till the second intermission? It's why a lot of their work is done on Saturday afternoon, because it doesn't do any good to go chase something on Thursday, because it's probably – you might have a basis for it.
Yeah.
You're better off getting it on Saturday afternoon as late as possible. But there are times we've had to put it out before, knowing that it's going to get out. Mm-hmm. So it's an ongoing conversation, but it's – you know what? It's worked out pretty well this year.
This year has worked out really well. Now, this is what I wanted to ask these guys, and we joked about it at the beginning. I'll tell you something. So Brian and I worked together. We worked together at The Fan, and then we worked together at The Score, and then I got hired at Hockey Night in Canada. And my first year at Hockey Night in Canada, we were doing a piece on Michael Pekka with the New York Islanders. And we were supposed to fly back on the Friday. We did the interview on the Friday. We were supposed to fly back, and the weather was so bad we couldn't get – from Long Island to the airport. So they said, okay, you're going to feed the story back from CBC Manhattan. The traffic was brutal. We were barely moving, and we were starving. So I was with Mike Dodson, who was a producer, and Mark Punga, who was the camera guy. And I said, guys, we're all hungry, right? And I go, yeah, we're barely moving. So we're in Manhattan. We're inching along. And I say, does anyone want a slice of pizza? And they go, okay, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to run out to that pizza shop over there, and I'm going to go grab the pizza, and I'll come back to the car. And they're like, well, what if we move, drive away? And I said, look around you. We're not going anywhere. So I go, I grab the pizza, I bring back a couple slices for everybody. And then in about the next week, I had a bunch of people at CBC say to me, like, what you did, we've never heard a poodle doing that before.
Poodle, by the way, is an industry term for on-air people.
Yeah. And I'm like, what are you guys talking about? And they go, well, a poodle is an on-air guy. Until I got to CBC, I'd never heard that before. So I said, what, nobody's ever done that before? They go, no, a poodle never would. And I go, I really don't think it's a big deal. So it is one of the things that some of my friends want to know is, what is it like dealing with the different – you said it earlier, it's a team. What's it like dealing with us? Because I think people would be curious.
I don't find it that difficult. And I don't surprised to hear that story, actually, because I don't find anyone any different than we're just a bunch of people. What I do think does happen, though, is that if you're a new producer, it's hard. Like, if you're a younger guy coming in the business right now trying to say, okay, I'm going to tell – here's what Elliot's doing or here's what Jeff's doing. You're telling now guys who have been doing it for 20 years, you know – I've been in this business for 25 years and Marzi for 19. So, A, you've gained a little bit of respect, but also I've kind of grown up with so many people who are on air. I consider peers there who are on air, with you guys or other people. So I don't find it that difficult. I don't find it a thing like dealing with on-air people. I find it more just dealing with people.
Mm-hmm. Marzi?
It's like when we got the national package, I'd worked with Darren, Nick, and Doug for years, and Jeff for part of the time as well. And you had a comfort level, but it was working with you or working with Ron, Elliot, that was, okay, I got to prove myself to you guys that you don't just think, oh, this guy doesn't know what he's doing, even though, you know, Nick or Doug would may have said good things about me. But I wanted to make sure that, you know, you had the faith in me that I wasn't going to do that. So working with that was just a little bit of justifying yourself to the new guys that you're working with. But each guy is different to deal with. Like, I talk differently on the phone with you about things than I would with Doug. But that's, you know, talking to an insider necessarily versus trying to get the coach's perspective of things. So that's a difference for me.
The best thing I think anyone can do is just get to know people. Like, don't make it so it's we're just the only time you ever have a conversation with a person is about the show.
Yeah.
Well, then there's going to be some tension about it. But if you know about the person's kids, you're just having a conversation. Then it's very easy to talk about the show, right? It's very easy to say, I didn't really like what we did there, or I didn't like this. And then the person doesn't feel guarded by it because you're just talking.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like the relationship I have with all the guys on Hockey Night is like that. And it's different with every guy. My relationship with Ron is different than it would be with David Amber. But I talk to all of them on a personal level, not just about the show.
Mm. By the way, Marzi, you failed.
Yeah.
Flunk. Growing up, like many, I watched Hockey Night in Canada. Dave Hodge was the presenter. And then it was Ron McLean. Like, these are the two that I look at in the position that I do in studio. And I say, you know what? Those are gold standard. Like, those are always the ones that you looked up to. From a producer's point of view, though, for other people in the industry that when you got in, you're like, wow, one day, that guy. That's what I want to be. Do you have that at all? At your level?
I don't think
it's a bit of the opposite.
I don't want to be like that guy.
There's a couple of guys that when I came into the business, I was like, I don't want to be like that guy.
So I'm not surprised to hear that.
But yeah, and that was what we talked about earlier, that, you know, there's some demonstrative people that were there. I was like, you know what? They might know their stuff, but I don't want to be like that guy in the
control. Do you ever catch yourself though? Like,
well, I've had a couple times where you're just like, oh, I should have said
that. Ooh, I was
that guy. Yeah. But for the most part, I think for the two or three bad apples, or what do you want to call them? There's 30 great people that you've met that you're like, okay, that's something I want to do. I want to pattern myself after this guy, or, you know, seeing the way Brian works in the control room, I'm like, and how authoritative he is in there, but in a calm presence, I'm like, that's, you know, something you always want to strive for. So, you know, there's that, but there was never a guy, like, it wasn't like, oh, I want to end up being this guy or that guy, but a couple guys that you wanted to avoid being like.
What do you think the future of Intermission Studio is?
I was going to ask that, like, where do you think we're going? That's what I wanted to ask.
Where is this thing headed? With so much information available online and so much video available online and other options, and the minute the period is over, you're competing hard to get people not to flip and to go somewhere else. What's the future of studio? Where does it go?
It has to never go off. It has to be that 24-hour news cycle, or if you're doing a game at 8 o'clock at night, or you're coming on at 6:30 with a show, your coverage needs to start first thing in the morning. Mm-hmm. So, well, your intermission stuff just becomes an extension of everything else that you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, we have to get to probably a point where we're out there all day on other, whether it's Facebook, whether it's Twitter, whatever it is. And then, yeah, the intermission comes, but that's just an extension of the other stuff that you've been presenting the rest of the day. It's a bigger undertaking.
I think, you know, the short attention span that you have as viewers now, you know, live sports is like the one destination thing that you still have. Everybody PVRs everything. Skip the commercials, get to my program, skip the commercials, or binge watch on Netflix. I heard a story the other day that Fox is in the States trying to just do one commercial in an hour. You know, just do one thing, maximize the money. Like, that's the thing. Like, if you could get the viewers to never leave, never have a reason, like the period ends and you just keep going for 18 minutes and go back and don't give them a chance to
and then
turn
the ads
channels.
Are just integrated somehow.
Right. And yeah, somehow you monetize things because you got to make money so that you guys can get paid.
Thank you.
Like, we're eating bags of Doritos while we talk for 18 minutes.
But you know what I mean? Like, if they could find a way to monetize that so you didn't give the viewer a chance to turn away and that you were up the whole time, I think that could be something that you're going to see. You don't want to see you guys wearing suits with, you know, sponsorship on them or something ridiculous like that, but who knows?
If that's the way to make money, right?
Like
right from the buzzer, we go right to the studio. And
you're on air for 6 hours straight. Like, if you're going to do a doubleheader, you're on for six. You know, there's the game in between, and you never leave. A way to keep the viewer to not tune away, as long as you're giving them content that they want to see.
So look at soccer. They squeeze back for commercials, right?
Yes.
They don't actually ever leave. I often wonder if you could get one sponsor for a game. Like you're saying, like Fox, and it's just like stay through the breaks, but it's like a sponsored feature for 90 seconds or something. I'm talking the game coverage. It's not your question about the intermissions, but.
Was it Fox this year that did 6-second commercials during football games?
Did they?
Yeah, I think so.
Elliot and I have talked a lot on this podcast about alternative streams, secondary streams, different types of information, games presented in different ways, running narrative over games.
Players only.
You know, that kind of idea. Mm-hmm. You see that on the horizon? I mean, basketball does
basketball
it.
Football does it, like the coaches thing for their championship.
I really
think
that's really
games.
Good. Yeah, I do.
Yeah. We've talked about it.
Yeah, we have.
I think, how do you say this politely? You know, those sports have the personalities and guys that are able to come
We've talked about this, and do that, right? Hockey stars don't go into TV.
Or the guys that you want to hear from go into management, and now they're not available. You know, it's, you know.
They don't do TV.
Like, well, the NHLPA poll came out yesterday, and favorite player was Peter Forsberg for the players. Like, it shows you the age group of, like, Peter Forsberg was the number one guy that guys in the league looked up to growing up. You know, Steve Yzerman was second on the list, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you want to have Yzerman on? Well, you can't because he's in Tampa. He's busy.
Also,
you know?
What I hear this morning, Peyton Manning's going to get $10 million to go into broadcasting.
Yeah.
I don't know what you guys are making, but
I don't think it's enough.
It's not $10 million.
You know, football, John Gruden got paid so much to go back to the Raiders just to get him off TV, and he was a reason why people wanted to stick around to watch.
That is true, too.
If the money's there, then you can do it. It's just... it's a different beast when you've got 300 million people you're serving versus 35. Sure.
Here's my last one for you. There's still, even though media is shrinking, there's still a lot of people who want to get in it, whether it's like Jeff and I in front of the camera, like you guys behind the camera. What's the best advice you would give to a young boy or girl who would want to get into television? Don't do it, Marzi.
Don't do it.
Well,
think when we started, you were at the Score.
Yeah.
I was at Sportsnet, and there's the other one. And, you know, now that's integrated, so there's less, like, Sportsnet and the Score together. There's less jobs, and then we had more shows a couple years ago, and all of a sudden, you're like, it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and, you know, don't get in the job. Don't get in the market, because I don't want my job to be taken, right? I'm joking, but, no, there's lots of things to work on, you know but there isn't. There's what?
You know what, though?
We have four
honestly,
hockey producers. That's it.
I find that don't go in the industry or don't do this is actually good advice. Because if someone's going to listen to you and not get into it, then they're not going to make it in the industry anyhow. Like, you want someone to hear that from you, Marzi, and say, F you.
Yeah, I want to take my chance.
I'm going to take my chance with this. So I don't disqualify that as bad advice, because that's actually gatekeeper advice that you're giving, and I agree with that.
The other advice, though, is I think that don't limit yourself now to television. Like, that's an old way of
thinking. Do everything.
Do everything, but also content's going to be needed. We're just distributing it a different way. So learn the different ways that the content's being distributed. Embrace yourself with the digital, but thinking that I want to be on TV or I want to produce a show, that's kind of small thinking now. Like, you've got to be thinking that you can create a podcast or you can create some online content show, whatever, but be thinking about that way rather than the traditional way.
I always tell kids when I get asked that question, start a blog, start a podcast.
Yeah.
All the tools are there for you that
YouTube.
We never had.
YouTube.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And just do it as a passion project, do it as a hobby, and see where it goes.
Or see where it goes.
See where it goes. Final thoughts from you guys. This is my last question. What do you want people to know about what you do? Like, do you think there are misunderstandings about what a producer does in television?
It's not just you. We can't do the show by ourselves. Like, it's not just the guys on air. And
we know the most important role is host. We understand that.
Yeah. But you know what I mean? Like, if Ron mentions a name other than somebody on set, it's Brian on Saturday or my name on Sunday.
Yep.
But there's 30 other people working super hard every night, if not like more in the trucks and everything. But what you're seeing on air.
Well, that's why I always like the final game of the Stanley Cup playoffs when there's the full role of everyone who's involved in the project.
Yeah. You don't realize that it's not just those six guys that you see or hear from. There's so many people that are working so hard to make the shows perfect that you can't do it by yourself. You can come up with great ideas, but unless you've got the people there to execute them for you, you don't have anything. So
here's your last word.
I agree. I totally agree with what Marzi said. That's actually the fun of it, is working with a whole group of people and that you enjoy coming to work and seeing, and the whole aspect of the team putting a show together, because you're not an island, that's for sure.
Beautiful. Thanks, boys.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
Sportsnet.ca is the home of hockey. Breakaways and breaking trades. Catch highlights, news, and expert analysis from the best in the business. featuring award-winning authors and must-read weekly features like Elliot Friedman's 31 Thoughts and Quick Shifts by Luke Fox. From the morning skate to the opening face-off, Canada's deepest roster of sports writers all in one place. Visit sportsnet.ca, the home of hockey.
Elliot Oscar Klefbom and the idea that they may be playing him simply to showcase him despite, I don't know what even type of injury to describe it as, but
shoulder,
despite,
I believe.
Despite him being a little bit banged up, let's just say.
I think a lot banged up. Like, I've written a couple times this year that Kessler is really being held together on duct tape, and yeah, a couple guys reached out to me to say they think Klefbom is too. I have written it a couple times this year. I don't understand why he's playing. Like, I get guys want to play, and you want to wait till someone's officially eliminated, but he's clearly hurting and there's no logical reason for it. And then finally someone said to me, you know, what could be going on here? They're going to make a move this year.
But how can it be a showcase if he's injured? He's not going to show well.
Well, I think people understand what he was, and you know,
so do you need to see him now? That's the point that I don't get. Like, if you're running him out there hurt, what's the value for anybody? Certainly not for Klefbom, not for the Oilers, and not for.
I don't know. I honestly, Jeff, there's so many questions about this thing that I have. I can't answer this question, but the fact is that I think that teams were scouting him, and I think people were looking at him, and I think they got to sign Darnell Nurse, who's had a really good year, and I think Klefbom's got value. He had a great year last year. He scored 12 goals. He's got a good contract. I do think people are looking at him.
What happens to Edmonton in the offseason?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I watched, I didn't see it on Saturday night because I was in Maryland, but I watched the interview after that David and Cassie and Doug did with Nicholson.
Yeah, it was really good.
Great to have you along, David Amber, Cassie Campbell-Pascal, Doug McLean, and yes, the CEO of the Oilers Entertainment Group, Bob Nicholson. Thanks for joining us, and congratulations on this amazing facility. I've got to talk a little bit about how it's been a tough season, obviously, for the on-ice product, and you know, we'll start with this, Bob. Over the next, you know, month here during the season and in the summer months as well, what's the one main thing you're hoping to accomplish here?
You know what? Right now, we're disappointed with the year. There's no question about it. We're going to take our time. We're going to make sure that we really evaluate every part of the hockey operation as well as everything within our organization. It's disappointing. We have a plan, and we're going to get it right.
You know, Bob, I remember when you first went from vice president to president of Hockey Canada. It wasn't always easy, and then all of a sudden you built it to this enterprise, and there was gold medals after gold medals. And I wonder, looking back at that and looking back at last year, do you think that this team didn't face enough adversity last year? It almost came a bit too easy.
You know what? That's a real good point, Cassie. You know, we really, everything worked out for us. All our players played extremely well, and expectation was really high in the summertime, and we couldn't get that under control, and that hurt us coming out of the gate. But we have some really good pieces, and I think the key, you know, people want change, but I'm going to be patient. I want to make sure that we really do a thorough evaluation and get it right, because we do have a lot of good things, and we don't want to destroy that.
Bob, one of the most important things during a tough year like this is motivating your management team, keeping them focused, dealing with that side of things, and then also dealing with an owner that would be very disappointed in how the season's gone.
Yeah, you know what? The relationship with Peter Chiarelli and Keith Gretzky has been very good. We're going to keep the plan. And in fairness, I talk to Darryl Cates all the time. Darryl Cates asks tough questions, but he's been really fair with me. I couldn't ask for a better situation to have an opportunity to turn this around.
Bob, it's such a passionate fan base here, getting a chance to interact with some of the fans. What's the message to the fans who you know, preaching patience is great, but for a lot of them, they're saying it's been so long now since we've kind of tasted what we want.
Yeah, you know, I came in, and it's been a number of years. This is my third year. We had a great year last year, but we did change coaches a lot here, and we did make a lot of changes. And, you know, I really feel that, hey, when you make a change, make sure you make a better change. Don't just make change for change. And we're not to that point to make the change, but we will be here at some time, and the fans will buy in if they can understand the plan once we make those changes.
You know, I thought Nicholson was dropping a lot of hints there, and you got the sense that he wanted to say a bit more, but he was really holding himself back. You know, he's got a long history with Cassie, and you know, I think he wanted to say some more stuff, and But the thing that really struck me is that they're going to make changes, but they're not going to make changes for the sake of doing it. And he said, we've fired a lot of people here. And I think he would prefer to keep Peter and Todd. That's the sense I got. But I think that may be decided by who else is available. Like, what if Barry Trotz is available? What if Joel Quenneville is available? And the other thing, too, is I don't know really who's making the final call here. Like, who do you think is making the final call in Edmonton?
By way of title, it should be Pete Chiarelli.
Or Bob. Or the owner.
Didn't the owner want a coaching move during the season? Wasn't it after that Dallas game?
Yeah.
There's, it was that road trip.
There's been some rumbling about that. This year you're talking?
This year, yeah. And, yeah. And Wayne Gretzky was on the road trip. And
there's been a rumor about that. I don't know if it's true, though. Daryl Cates, he doesn't come out very much. Like, it's hard to check that kind of thing.
Every time I talk to anyone there, it's Cates is fuming.
Yeah,
Cates is fuming about this season.
I agree with that. Somebody told me last year they have the highest revenue team in the NHL. And they're not going to be that way this year because that arena is such a cash cow.
Yeah.
And they're not going to be there this year. And I do believe that Daryl's upset, but who's making the call? Is it Cates? Is it Nicholson? Is it Chiarelli? Is it Wayne Gretzky? Is it somebody else? Like, nobody really seems to have the answer to that.
And what's Paul Coffey's role here?
My guess is he ends up coaching, but I don't know if that's head coach or assistant coach.
Scouting in Ontario.
When I heard that,
I was saying.
Could he be a GM? And I've been told he's got no desire to be a GM. I think he wants to coach.
Right.
So that's my biggest question is who's making the call?
How close do you think they are to turning it around? Knowing the composition of this team, knowing the
They're
woes.
Not as bad as they played this year. I refuse to believe that.
They need wingers.
But
bad.
That should be, in theory, the easiest thing to find. Now, I will say this. I think one of the things they're going to have to figure out is how to convince Connor McDavid and Leon Draisaitl that they shouldn't play together.
They want to play with each other.
Yeah,
they
but
want,
I think
they're on the same line.
I think that's got to change.
Eventually.
You've got to show them Pittsburgh and say, guys, why did they win two Stanley Cups back-to-back? Because you got Crosby on one and Malkin on another, and you get someone like Kessel and he plays on a third.
Yzerman, Fedorov, keep going. Like,
you got to. Those guys are going to have to learn that they can't play together. Maybe in certain situations, Crosby and Malkin play together on the power play.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you put them together on a line here and there. But generally, they got to play apart.
They need a save. And you're just hoping this is just the outlier year for the netminder, and he comes back like he did last season.
Well, look, like, yeah, I agree with you. Talbot had a rough year. But you look at their team this year, you know, Larson was worse than last year. Klefbom, because of the injury, was worse than last year. Sequeira, who was, you know,
injured
a pretty big player for them,
January.
Was out for half the year. Sometimes you have to bet on our guys are not going to be that bad again. Like, things are going to be better next year.
But you're not going to go into next season with the same lineup.
No. That's why I wonder about the Klefbom thing.
But then again, the idea of, you know, we're not going to make changes just for the sake of making changes. I mean, you've got a fan base that's torches at the Castle Gate right now.
Yeah.
Like, that volcano needs a virgin. Like,
you know,
something's
gotta
happen.
I got in enough trouble last week for what I said about Vancouver. But you know what? Some of the funniest tweets I got back about it was Edmonton fans saying, wait, we're worse than they are.
Hang on. How dare you? We're number one.
You know, I get that in Edmonton's case. They've missed the playoffs, 11 of the last 12 years? Like, yeah. You know, I think in that situation.
1 year out of 10, you get a good season. Like, it's got
to
end.
I think in that situation, you've earned the right to be upset if you support the team and you support the organization. Again, Jeff, my biggest question about them is, at the end of the day, who's making the calls here?
Mm-hmm.
Whose choice is it? And until you know who that is, it's very difficult to predict what they're going to do.
Wednesday, you were part of it in studio. I did ringside for the Calgary Flames-Buffalo Sabres game. And hanging around the organization in Buffalo, albeit just for a day, I don't know that Jason Botterill doesn't think that this job is even bigger than he thought when he first took the gig.
I agree.
At every single level,
there are
problems with the Buffalo Sabres. You could look at last year's draft and say, top three teams, all of them are in the playoffs. New Jersey, Philadelphia, Dallas. Wow, quick turnaround. Wow, that's great. Buffalo's not making the playoffs next year. Like, there's no miracle turnaround here.
It's a big, big job. And, you know, the other thing, too, is they couldn't create a market for a Vander Kane that they wanted to create.
Yeah.
They did the best they could, and in the eyes of a lot of their fans, it wasn't good enough, but there wasn't a big market there. And, you know, there wasn't a big market for Robin Lehner. I don't think there was much there.
By the way, in the organization, there are six goaltenders in the system, only two under contract. One of them,
Ullmark
is the
one.
And
he's going to be the guy, I think.
Internally, I was told that they don't think he can shoulder a full season's worth of work. He's probably a year away from that.
So do they give him a taste next year, or do they put him back in the A?
My instinct is he's back in Rochester. He does get a taste, and they got to figure out who their starting netminder is, and they may have to bite the bullet and go on a one-year contract with Robin Lehner again.
And he'll be a UFA the year after, right?
Think so. He's restricted this year.
Yes.
Chad Johnson's a UFA.
Yes.
So
I
that's a tough one.
Yeah. And also, which of their guys have value?
To move?
Yeah.
Okposo has the big name, also has the big ticket. Man, a lot of those guys.
And he's coming back from a pretty tough injury.
Sure is. The problem with the Sabres, too, is, I mean, you look at the construction of this team. You know, Jack Eichel is a really fast hockey player, but this is a slow team.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a team that's almost like built for 15 years ago.
Well, you're not trading Eichel, so.
Oh, God, no.
So who are you trading there for pieces that can help you?
You wonder if a player like Sam Reinhart.
How much value does he have?
Don't know. Since January, he's been a much better player.
Yeah.
You wonder about Alex Nylander, who has continued to struggle in Rochester.
Been rough.
Within the organization, there are some that wonder if he'll ever play 100 games in the NHL. And that's a first-round pick. And you know what happens when you miss on your first round. That's a top 10 pick, too.
Would you trade Ristolainen?
I think he's a good second-pairing guy. I think he's cast as a first-pairing guy by necessity.
Now, I think you could get something for him.
What?
What are you asking for?
Well, if
he's got term. He's signed for what, four more years?
Yep.
That's value because he's cost-controlled.
But it depends how you see him. Like, if you see him as a first-pairing guy, you're going to be disappointed, and that's what Buffalo
has by
necessity.
Well, I'm sure some teams will take him for a second pair happily.
See, the pipeline for the Sabres, like, no one's coming, right? The interesting thing to me for Buffalo is, what are they going to do with Casey Mittelstadt?
I saw you talk about him last night. I meant to put it in my notes. I'll probably put it in next week, but I think he's going to take to the summer to decide. I wondered if he was going to show up right now to burn his 10 games of his ELC.
Yeah,
I'm not sure that's going to happen.
32 points in 39 games, something like that.
He is
11 goals.
Talented guy.
Super talented. Consistency, as one person from the organization told me yesterday, has been an issue for Mittelstadt. But you wonder if there's going to be the full court press. He's a freshman.
Yeah.
You wonder if there's going to be a full court press to get him to turn pro.
If I was them, I would.
To put him where, though?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. I bet you
Rochester
he'd
or
rather
Buffalo.
Play in school than go to the American Hockey League.
That's it.
Yeah.
You want to be a Gopher, you want to be a Rochester American.
Yeah, that, I understand that.
Like, up the gut for the next 10 years is going to be Eichel and Mittelstadt. It's only a matter of when is it right to turn Mittelstadt and O'Reilly and to turn Mittelstadt pro.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one. I think the other one, too, is they have started recently. They have some big wins, but they haven't always played hard. Like, Arizona, which is now out of last place, they play hard.
Last 15 games.
You know, even at the beginning of the year, I thought they played pretty hard at times. They just couldn't make a save, and they blew a lot of games.
Mm-hmm.
But they're starting to play a lot harder. Buffalo doesn't come across. I mean, they always get up for Toronto. But
beat some biggies. I mean, they beat Tampa.
But
they
generally
beat Boston.
They don't play that hard.
Yeah. That's what Phil Halsey was saying after the game yesterday, too. I mean, that was lick the envelope, mail it in.
I have a soft spot for the Buffalo Sabres.
So
like, when I would go to school in London, I would always go to games at the Odd. They'd cross over the bridge and go to games at the Odd. They are a great sports town. They are a great NHL city. Whether the Sabres are playing or not, they watch games.
TV numbers are always great.
Like, a fan base that deserves to be mad, they're probably right at the top.
I went to University of Guelph, not that far from London, and I did the same. You know,
song we used to sing with the Guelph teams when I went to Western? That's all right. That's okay. You're going to work for us one day.
I can't tell you the theme that we used to have about the kids from Western. By the way, it's not appropriate for a family style podcast. But I would go like at least a couple of games.
I heard them.
At least a couple of games a month down to the. Actually, I was there when McGillney broke his leg. I was like, right. Oh, I can still hear the scream, too. Oh, it's ringing in my. Anyway, And so I'm with you. Like, the Buffalo Sabres and that fan base, and even just talking to some of the kids at the Zamboni door yesterday as well, like, these are long-suffering,
yes,
but hockey-knowing fans. Like, it's a great hockey
market.
It's
a great hockey market.
Awesome hockey market. And as much as you look for rivalries to get rejuvenated, and listen, I'm one that has my fingers crossed for that Florida-Tampa first-round matchup should the Cats get in there. I'm waiting for...
The NHL needs that Florida-Florida series.
Big time. The other one,
they need that.
The other one that I'm waiting for is Winnipeg and Minnesota. Please let them meet in the playoff because geographically they're close and there's a border between them.
Yeah, that's fair.
I would love to see that. I know in the back of everyone's mind there's Vancouver and Seattle down the road. But that Buffalo-Toronto thing is so waiting to happen. QEW series not too far away from...
99, right?
What's
that? That was the last time we had it, 1999.
1999, that's right. And it's, you know, the sidebar story of Eichel versus Matthews, Toronto versus Buffalo. Like, a lot of it really lines up. But this is a franchise that has a lot more heavy lifting to go.
Yeah.
That has a lot to do. I want to conclude with something we've been teasing for a couple of weeks now, and that's going to be so anticlimactic. Players in the game right now that you could see coaching. Made a few phone calls a few weeks ago, and two names kept coming back.
Okay.
But in the NHLPA poll,
mm-hmm.
5.7 respondents said Sidney Crosby. I can't see that.
I can't see him having the patience for that, but okay.
Derek Stepan, 4.5%.
Interesting.
Jason Spezza, 4.5%.
Spezza's one of the smartest guys out there. Yeah, he watches a lot.
Matt Cullen, 4.5%.
Yeah, people like Matt Cullen.
Jonathan Toews, 3.6%.
He'll have $100 million in the bank. He's gonna
want no doesn't need to coach. Okay, so when I called around a few weeks ago, two names kept coming back to me.
Was one Blake Como?
No.
I got that a lot. Actually.
You did, eh?
Yeah.
The two names were Alex Burrows.
Yeah.
Who's already, as has been described to me, thinking that in the back of his mind. And the other is Derek McKenzie.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Florida obviously thinks very highly of him.
Like, he's led practice before. Coach isn't on the ice. Derek McKenzie's a guy doing it. I'll just throw it out. Those are the two that kept coming back to me, Alex Burrows and Derek McKenzie.
I think those would both be really interesting choices. Blake Como's name is a name that's come up to me a lot, that he's a guy who is smart enough and knows enough that he could do it. You know, one guy I always wondered if he'd want to do it would be Saku Koivu. He was someone who always, I thought, could be a coach.
Yeah.
But I'm guessing we're not going to see him. Koivu was a guy who jumped out to me.
Someone on my timeline, like a few people on my timeline saying Chris Kunitz, Tampa.
Yeah, does he want to do it? He's a smart guy. Guy's a hell of a career.
Mm-hmm. You know, I always thought in the back of my mind, Chad LaRose.
And he disappeared.
Vanished and then came back. Come back to the American Hockey League.
Chad LaRose, I wouldn't have even thought of that. Not that it's bad, it wouldn't have been a guy who popped into my head.
I always loved Chad LaRose because he was the one guy who played the entire CompuWare system. I don't think he ever played for a team that wasn't owned by Peter Karmanos, going back to minor hockey, because he played in the CompuWare system, Plymouth Whalers of the Ontario Hockey League, drafted by the Carolina Hurricanes, always played with Carolina. He was the day one CompuWare hockey player.
Mm-hmm.
From day one on skates, he always played for Pete Karmanos' own team. Don't know anyone else that ever did that. That's what I can bring to the podcast this week, Elliot.
That's good.
That's all I got.
Think.
That's it. I'm out of thoughts now. Read Elliot Friedman's 31 thoughts at sportsnet.ca. Thanks for our producer, Emil Delich. And thanks for tuning in. Thanks for the downloads. Thanks for all the kind words. I don't know if you get this, but when I was in Buffalo a couple of days ago or yesterday, had a lot of people, Flames, Sabres, and fans alike, just pull aside and say how much they enjoyed the podcast. So thank you for the well wishes, the kind words, the reviews on iTunes. They all count. Thank you for doing that. Friege, any last thought from you? Thought 32? Conclude the podcast?
I'm going on vacation next week. I'm looking forward to that.
Enjoy.
Now, we're
going
to tape a special Ask 31, right?
Yep, we are.
Okay.
All right, enjoy that one, and thanks for enjoying this podcast. We'll talk to you in 6 days.